For those of you who have not met with us, we are studying the story of the prodigal son, and we come to the last installment in that story in Luke's Gospel. And this morning we're going to look at the life of the older brother. And before we do that, I just wanted to remind us of how shocking it must have been for those first century Jewish people who first met and heard Jesus. Because in many ways, Jesus established relationships that had to be terribly confusing to the people who first encountered him. There are a number of relationships that we can cite, but three of them, three relationships in particular, had to be confusing. One was the way in which he welcomed the poor and sinners. If he was the promised Messiah, they expected him to deliver the poor and the sinners, but not to basically spend so much time with them. He basically was way above that. And it was commonly thought that if you were poor, you were probably a sinner, because the way in which God blessed you was in keeping with how he viewed you. And material blessing was the essence of shalom for many people. Peace on the inside and prosperity on the outside. And the poor were seen as rather pathetic. They were disqualified from much of civil life. And Jesus seemed to be drawn to the poor. Matter of fact, he seemed to be one with them. The second area that had to be confusing was the fact that Jesus basically ignored political power. The institutions of power, be they from the Roman government or from within Judaism, were ignored by Jesus. And if he was indeed someone who was Messiah, you'd expect him to be a political figure. He wasn't. And to this day, people on the right and the left politically would like to make Jesus a political figure and try very hard to shoehorn certain passages of Scripture into a political ideology to get Jesus to be a chaplain for their system. More the left than the right. But we are disappointed and confused. But nowhere was the confusion more stark than in his relationship to the Jewish leadership, the scribes, the Pharisees, the priests. If the Messiah was to do anything, he was to basically come with a parade of priests, Pharisees, and scribes alongside him. They would introduce him to Israel. The Messiah had come. But Jesus had not only little to do with them, what he had to do with them was not very encouraging. He was most critical of the Jewish leadership spiritually. All of these things were things the disciples, the first disciples, had to process when they grew to embrace him as Messiah. How would these things fit together? Of all bad men, religious bad men are the worst, said C.S. Lewis. And I think we live in an age in which we have seen that, both from afar and from within. In the parable of the prodigal son, we come now to the story of the older brother. And again, for those of you who perhaps aren't as familiar with the parable, most of us are, the parable starts with the prodigal running away after getting his inheritance, leaving home, becoming destitute through worldly living, and coming to his senses, he is brought home, he repents to his father, and his father welcomes him with lavish grace. And it's in this context that the last installment or chapter in the parable takes place. The older brother becomes bitter, feeling that the father has unfairly been gracious to this sinning younger brother. And the older brother is incensed because, as we're going to see in the text, he was slaving all his life to please his father, and he didn't get the same kind of gracious treatment in his view. So let's read the the story picking up at verse 25. After the father had lavishly and graciously welcomed the returning prodigal son. Now his older son, father's older son, was in the field. And when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing, and he summoned one of the servants and began inquiring what these things could be. And he said to him, "Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf because of his, because he has received him back safe and sound." But he became angry and was not willing to go in. And his father came out and began pleading with him. But he answered and said to his father, "Look, for so many years I have been serving," really the word is slaving, "I've been slaving before you, and I have never neglected a command of yours, and you have never given me a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours," and you notice the plain words here, he's your son, not my brother, "this son of yours came, who has devoured your wealth with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him." And he said to him, "Son, you have always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live, and was lost and has been found." The play on words here is, I think, not without effect. Henry Ward Beecher had this to say: "You and I do not see things as they are. We see things as we are." Ooh. And in this story, the prodigal son's brother sees his circumstances in such a way that we see the prodigal son's brother's heart. He doesn't see what those who have followed Christ throughout generations understand, the grace of God. He does not see that grace. He sees this story, this gracious act in the Father, as it comes from the tinted lenses of his own heart, of his own problems. If you remember that the chapter begins in verse 15 of Luke with these words. This sets the stage for the parables. And it gives us an understanding of what Jesus is getting to in the parable. "Now all the tax gatherers and the sinners were coming near him to listen to him," that is to Jesus. "And both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.' So he told them this parable, saying," and then he tells us the parable of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and then finally the lost son, returning back. So what Jesus is doing here, he's making a point about grace. And he's responding to those Pharisees who looked down their nose, not only at the poor, but at Jesus for siding with the poor. Now all the tax, there are a number of observations we can make here. The older son's attention in the story is aroused not when the younger son leaves, not when the younger son gets in trouble, but not when the younger son comes back. As far as we can tell, there's no indication that the older brother stirs or does anything. What wakes him up is the grace of the father. When the father basically runs to meet the prodigal son and welcome him home and lavishes upon him these gifts of honor and privilege and of inheritance and kills the fatted calf for him and celebrates his homecoming, that's when the older son wakes up. That's when all of a sudden we have his attention. It's the grace that basically is intolerable. We go back to the context of these parables. When the Pharisees and scribes see Jesus basically embracing the poor, embracing sinners, that's when they're upset. Jesus could teach ethics, no problem with that. He could teach basically the coming kingdom, no problem with that. But when he starts showing grace to people who don't deserve it, haven't earned it, that's where the scribes and Pharisees are awakened, just like the older brother. And I think this is the context in which Jesus is hoping to make his point. The second point is this, or the second observation is this. The older son is a mirror of the Jewish leaders. And the intent, I believe, is this. Just as the prodigal came to his senses once he saw himself, Jesus, in telling this story, this parable, is hoping that his audience, the scribes and Pharisees, will see the light, come to their senses, and get it, and say, wow, we're looking in a mirror. We are the older son. But of course, we have no indication that ever happened. We don't know. But based upon the history of Jesus' relationship with the scribes and Pharisees, up until his crucifixion and after, there was no sign of any relief or change. I'm going to suggest there are three characteristics of the older brother's religious spirit. One, it's a scorekeeping spirit. Two, it's a superficial spirit. And three, it's a separatist spirit. And I want to look at the older son's spirit as a mirror for us. Because I'm going to suggest, if we don't get it, that we should be looking at this man as a mirror. In the same way, the father is a mirror to us, the prodigal is a mirror to us, the older brother is a mirror. All of these characters in the story can tell us something about our own heart. And if spiritual formation starts with knowing yourself, this is the way, or one of the ways in which we should look at this story. A scorekeeping spirit. Going back to the text. But he answered and said to his father, look, for so many years I have served or slaved for you, and I have never neglected a commandment of yours. What he's saying there is this, I've been keeping score. And right now, I've got a pretty good batting average. A whole lot better than the other team over here, your other son. I've been keeping score. As a matter of fact, I've been doing a great sacrifice. I've been slaving for you. Every time you said jump, I said how high? On the way up. Now, what more do you want? You reward him. I have not seen a reward. I've not seen anything like that kind of treatment. Now, of course, we're going to, in a little while, look at the father's response. And his response at first may seem a little strange to us until we understand something of the context in which he's saying what he does about, look, everything I have is yours. You've always been here for me. That sounds as though he's really endorsing the older son in a way in which he really is not. What he's doing is he's telling the older son, listen, you haven't lost a thing. What's gotten you is the fact that I've been gracious to someone you didn't think deserved it. You've lost nothing. But it's my grace that gets to you. Scorekeeping spirits are rules-driven. That's the way we keep score. They are performance-focused. It's all about how am I doing with the rules. And justice-sensitive. I'm entitled if I'm good. Now, I like mercy and grace when I fail. But with respect to my merits, I want credit for every one of them. I have been faithful in attending church. I even go on Wednesday night. And I go to prayer meeting often. I read my Bible every day. I missed a couple days last month, but I doubled up the next week to make up for it. And now you tell me, through my doctor, that I've got cancer. I mean, why did I do that anyway? I would do all that work, you know, being a good Christian, following the rules of the Christian culture, and here I am, 42, with cancer. Oh. What can you do in a situation like that? How do you deal with a God like that?
He forgot to tithe.
Oh, yes. Oh. But this is a debated. Obedience for the purpose of gaining something in this life by way of reward. Now, I don't suspect that it is easy for any of you to identify with that. But you have some friends who can identify with that. I can remember how proud my mother was of her little Jimmy, because he had 14 years of perfect attendance at Sunday school.
Hallelujah!
I had a little pin with a 14 on it. No one had 14. There were a couple 10s, but no 14s. Now, very frankly, that didn't mean much to me, but it meant a lot to my mother. I mean, it was a sign that she had been a good, faithful mother. Most of us, unfortunately, find ourselves, not overtly, but at least covertly, keeping score. You know, basically, when we make a sacrifice, it's a sacrifice that's really an investment, oftentimes, to God. If we give up something, we expect that this is going to come back to us in some very good ways. And when it doesn't, we do not feel something is right. We start checking our records. Did I miss something here? Tithing. That was it. Or something. There are two kinds of men. The righteous who believe themselves sinners. The rest, sinners who believe themselves righteous. Pascal's words. That's probably pretty true. I've mentioned several times a comment that my friend David Spence made in praying with John Stott. David Spence was responsible for his literature trust. And he would go to John Stott's flat a couple times a year to meet with him. And he said, we get down by his bed. He had a small little apartment and a single bed. Get on our knees and pray. And he said, I've told this several times. He said, when I hear John Stott pray, I think I was sitting next to an axe murderer. I mean, he would confess sins as though basically he had basically jeopardized his relationship with God in ways in which it could not be repaired. I mean, his heart would break in confessing his sins. Now, if anyone here has had any personal contact with John Stott, you'd probably say, as most of us would say, who have met him, there's no one who's more pious than Dr. Stott. His contribution to the Christian church is remarkable. The sacrifices he was willing to make in terms of service of others, impeccable. The way in which he was able to give up fame and fortune with ease in following Christ and give his multiple talents and wealth through the royalties of his publishing to third world Christians was an exemplary. And yet he was ever more aware and imminently aware of his shortcomings. He knew he was a sinner in need of grace, and he had not outgrown that need. On the other hand, I've known a number of people who prided themselves in their accomplishments for the Lord and lived with a sense of entitlement and looked down their nose at people who basically were of a different class, who hadn't received the same experiences they'd had, who hadn't received the same enlightenment they'd had, who didn't have the same gifts they'd had. And we know God was rewarding them because they had made lots and lots of money. They had lots of attention. They were invited to fancy places to speak. They had organizations named after them, even schools named after them. They had publishers willing to pay millions of dollars to get them to write a book because they knew it would sell. And had found themselves in those situations of being, God must really have not only favored me, but really like what I'm doing. I'm doing the right thing. I'm just going to keep doing more of it. I mean, a lot of it's about me, but God must like that. He must like me. Hey, it's all about me. You know, that you've heard the difference between cat religion and dog religion? Yeah, you've heard that one. You haven't heard that one? The dog says to his master, you feed me, you curry me, you give me a warm place to sleep, and you play with me. You must be God. And the cat says, you feed me, you give me a place to stay, you play with me, I must be God.
Amen.
Well, no cats and dogs, you understand. Luke 10, verse 20. Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your name is recorded in heaven. The disciples came back after following Jesus, and he sent them out to cast out demons and to heal. They came back and said, this is really great. We're casting out demons. The demons respond to us in your name. And they're excited about what God's Spirit and God's power is doing through them. But Jesus has these words for them. He says, basically, the issue is not what God does through us, but rather what God has done for us. Don't rejoice that you have got power. Don't rejoice that basically you're moving mountains. Don't rejoice that you are basically a VIP in the Christian culture. Rejoice that your name is written in heaven, that you're a recipient of God's grace. These are profound words. And he said to him, son, you have always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has become alive, has begun to live, and was lost and has been found. The older son lost nothing. He just did not want the prodigal to get anything. And when the father reminds the older son, you haven't, that's the way I paraphrase this. He said, you haven't lost a thing. You haven't lost a thing here. But don't you see that the son that was lost has been found now? We had to celebrate. We had basically to welcome him back. And the older brother doesn't get it. As a matter of fact, I've been a bit embarrassed. I've talked to a few Christian disciples who I've respected, who have looked at this story, and they said, I don't get it. You know, the older brother really is the hero here. What is the problem? Yes?
Does it feel like the older brother is saying, don't you love me? And you take a look at two people, and you've got one person who's been doing everything he can to impress his father, doing everything he can to obey his father, and his father's shown no love at all, hasn't even given him a young kid to rejoice with his
right.
Right. And yet his brother, who's done none of that, is being shown lots of love by his father. And how can you, he doesn't rebuke the older brother. As far as I can tell, there's no rebuke here at all. But he's trying to tell him is, yes, he does love him. And everything he has to his older brother. He's not,
I think it's safe to say that Jesus wants the scribes and Pharisees to see the love and grace of God and to receive it. To do that, they have to see themselves in ways in which they're not seeing themselves in the present. And I think you're exactly right. The story is not meant here to condemn the scribes and Pharisees. The story is here to bring them to the place where they, like the prodigal son, recognize the value, their need for grace, and the glory of God's grace, which is something they didn't see in Jesus, weren't willing to see. I think the case is often made, I think Tim Keller makes this case, this point, that both the older son and the younger son seem to have a preoccupation with the stuff, with the father's stuff. The younger son wants his inheritance early before the father dies and runs off and spends it. The older son is now all concerned about the stuff. I've worked so hard for you, and now I'm not getting what I expected, or what, he doesn't say this, but perhaps what I deserve. Yes.
In that vein, do you think the older son sees the younger son as a threat? In other words, you already got your inheritance. Now you're coming back. Everything that's here is supposed to be mine, right? I mean, what's left is mine, not yours. So he comes back and he sees him like, wait, you want some more of the stuff. You're coming back and here's daddy giving you my stuff.
Well, it may. I think we're chasing rabbits here that he can't catch. But the point of the parable is recognizing the glory of grace.
Unmerited. Undeserved.
Yeah, undeserved. Grace is always that way.
And the older brother
doesn't. But we're going to see this isn't the only place where Jesus makes this point. As a matter of fact, Jesus wears this point out in his ministry to a large extent. That's the point. There's a lot of things that we can imagine that are part of the culture that go into what's said and what's not said here to put more flowers in the garden, you know, of the story. But the real point we don't want to miss, and that is the fact that in these three parables, the lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost son, the punchline is the joy of finding, the joy of returning. And the grace of God shown to those who don't deserve it. That's how this chapter starts. Jesus was basically spending time, giving time to people. He was Messiah, giving time to people who didn't deserve his attention. And more than that, he was basically showing tenderness to them, even forgiving them. This could not be right. And it's in that context that these stories are told. So I think after we have all these theories about how this might work out in different scenarios, that's the point we don't want to miss. I think it's significant to look at passages like John 21, verse 21, where at the end of Jesus' ministry, Jesus comes to Peter and he says, Peter, I'm paraphrasing here, Peter, you're going to die by carrying a cross like I did. You're going to die the way I died. And then Peter gets a little anxious, understandably. So Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, Lord, and what about this man, pointing to John? Jesus said to him, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. And what Jesus is saying is this. Life is a game, and we keep score to be sure it is fair. Now, why did you bless him or her and not me or us? That's the way in which we think. And that's the American way. It's basically a matter of achievement and reward. Why are people poor? They're lazy and foolish. Of course. Next question. I mean, that's kind of the American situation we're in. Especially if we're not poor. It's easy for us to say, if you're not poor, you're lazy or foolish. Jesus would have had a hard time with many modern evangelical culture situations or settings for that reason. He would have basically upset us the way he upset the early disciples. But Jesus is taking, in this situation, is telling Peter, he said, Peter, you have got your part in the play. John's got his part. His part may look more attractive, but that's his part, not yours. Your part may be a bit part, and it may be a painful part, but it's your part. And your job is to play your part, not his. Yes?
Once again, I think it brings out the extreme individualism of Christianity. We are saved and we function as individuals, and Christ responds to us as individuals. And so we can't analyze our fellow man
right.
In the same sense as
we can't. We aren't to compare ourselves to one another.
Relationship. Yeah.
In Romans chapter 12, when he talks about these variety of gifts, he talks about the importance of operating your gift according to your faith, or the faith given to you. And I interpret that to mean, understand the boundaries of your gift. Understand how faith basically allows you to work in those boundaries. If you're a teacher, then you teach in those boundaries. That's what you do. You don't try to be a mercy person or a manager or a giver. That doesn't mean you don't do those things. But that's not your part in the play. That's not your main role. Do your main role right. And then the first book that I wrote, Put Your Best Foot Forward, the whole point I wanted to make in that book is that congregations have a personality and have gifts and strengths. Put your best foot forward, don't kick your neighbor, and don't lose your balance. That's the point of the book. Don't criticize other churches and other people because they're different than you are. They have different strengths, different roles. But don't lose your balance, recognizing my gift may not be mercy, but that doesn't mean I shouldn't show mercy. It just means that is not basically where I spend most of my energy and time. But it may be where you spend most of your energy and time. And that's where it should be. But that's the point you're making, Dorothy. It's a good one. The score-keeping spirit reacts to grace given to others. We want it for ourselves, but not for ourselves, not for those that don't deserve it. Another story from Jesus' teaching, Matthew chapter 20. For the kingdom of heaven is like a man who was a master of a household and went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. And he describes he offered a day's wage for someone who worked a whole day, and he offered to pay someone who would work half a day and someone who would work just an hour. And then verse 11. When the first came, he supposed that they could receive more, and they likewise each received a denarius, a day's wage. When they received it, they murmured against the master of the household, saying, these last have spent 1 hour, and we have made them equal, and you've made them equal to us, who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. But he answered and said to them, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Didn't you agree with me for a denarius? Take that which is yours and go your way. It is my desire to give to this last just as much as to you. Isn't it lawful for me to do what I want with what I what is my own or what I own? Or is your eye evil because I am good? So the last shall be first and the first shall be last. And many are called, few are chosen. And the point he's making here, of course, is this. God is not unfair by being gracious and generous. He seems unfair to those who are keeping score and who are basically looking at merit as an investment for a reward. The bad news is God is not fair. And the good news is God is not fair. Depending on who you see it or how you see it. In other words, what we see tells us more about ourselves than it does about the events. When I am basically aware of my sin, I am glad God is not fair. When I am having a pride parade in terms of all my accomplishments, and when I see people around me being rewarded for accomplishing nothing, or being delinquent even, then I want God to be fair. It's a superficial spirit. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, Matthew 23, verse 27. Hypocrites, for you're like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside they are full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. I ran across this quote I thought was interesting. This is what Oxford Don, speaking of another. On the surface he's profound, but deep down he's superficial.
Ouch!
Only an Oxford Don could come up with a line like that. And I think there's something of that in the older brother. You can look at him one way and say, he's got every right to be upset. And then you look a little deeper and you say, he's not getting it. He's missing it. Both sons seem preoccupied with the father's wealth more than the father. The younger son, because he wanted his inheritance to go his own way. The older brother is thinking about the wealth and not the family. Of course, you're reading a little bit into that. To get to that conclusion, you read a little bit into the nuancing of the words here. But I think the point for us, at least for me, is this. Don't settle for a look-good, feel-good religion. And we live in a culture right now where Christianity can be boiled down into basically three things. If you're on the political right, it's generally look good, feel good. If you're on the political left, it's do good. But in all cases, it's all about me. Or what I call the unholy trinity, me, now, and the stuff. I want the stuff now. By stuff I mean not just material things, I mean happiness. I mean the American dream. And as long as Jesus helps me reach the American dream now, I mean quick, I don't want to wait until I'm retiring. I want it before I retire. I want it early. And I want it long. As long as God helps me do that, I'm all for God. But when I serve Him, make these investments, and do the right things for a long period of time, I'm expecting a payout at some point. And I'm going to be very, very disappointed if I die early and poor and unhappy. That is a line of the pastor. I hear that a lot. Why is God doing this to me? Why is this happening to me? What else could I have done? So forth and so on. Matthew 23. Then Jesus spoke to a multitude of his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Listen to them. But they do all their deeds to be noticed by men. For they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen the tassel of their garments. They love the place of honor in the banquets, and the chief seats in the synagogue, and respectful greetings in the marketplace, and being called by men Rabbi, Rabboni." Luke 18, 10 to 14. And he also told us this parable, a certain one who trusted in themselves, and they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. Two men went into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax gatherer, a publican. The Pharisee stood and was praying thus to himself, "God, I thank thee that I am not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, and even like this tax gatherer. I fast twice a week. I pray tithes of all that I get." But the tax gatherer, standing some distance away, was even unwilling to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself shall be humbled, and he who humbles himself shall be exalted." Again, I mentioned earlier, this theme, the theme of the older brothers not getting it, is a theme that is very common in Jesus' teaching. Now, generally what happens is that when we basically make our spirituality superficial, we ignore and change the rules. I've used this diagram before to illustrate two aspects of holiness. When a person is baptized into Christ, they are positionally and legally declared holy, perfect, because God sees in us Christ. Our actual performance may be sketchy in real life. Our experience will be up and down. We are not completely holy. But the Corinthians were saints by calling, but they were mere men and they're walking. Now, what happens with a scorekeeping and superficial Christianity is we basically lower the bar so that that it becomes attainable. In other words, I tithe, I don't commit adultery, I haven't killed anyone, I don't even lie
much.
Now, there's a thing about jealousy and anger and coveting, and we're not going to go there. You know, that is something, we're just human in those situations. We make the law something we can manage. And usually, even if we can't manage even the big stuff, we tend to write the rules in such a way that the only things that really count are the things that basically go on our report card as A's and B's. The D's and F's just don't get there. Self-righteousness belongs to the narrow-minded, who don't get the picture, don't see the whole thing. The Sermon on the Mount, basically, was one of Jesus' attempts to break people out of narrow-mindedness. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you, these are the words of Jesus, that everyone who has anger with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever shall say to his brother, Raca, or to curse him, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever shall say, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. And we say, hold it, come on. I can't even say you fool. I mean, how am I going to get a job in broadcasting? I can't call somebody a fool. We're in politics. But Jesus is making the point here, when you lower the bar, I'm going to raise it back up. I'm going to put the bar so high that you're going to find it impossible not to be brought to your knees and be hungry and thirsting for righteousness that you can't achieve yourself. It's a separatist spirit also. He became angry and was not willing to go in. And his father came out and began pleading with him. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your wealth with prostitutes, the older brother is saying, this son of yours, he's not a brother of mine. I want no part of him. And he said, I will have no part of the feast. So in the end of the story, we have the family celebrating, and the older brother self-excluded. He refuses to be a part of the celebration. The story that of the older brother before us reminds me of two other stories, the story of Eve and the story of Martha. They have this in common. In the case of Eve and Martha, it's all about me. In a sense, it's about, in the case of Eve, it's I don't want to miss out. And Satan tempts her by saying, God knows that you're going to miss out if you do not stick up for yourself. If you don't stick up for yourself, no one else will. God knows that if you eat of this, if you take a courageous step, you're going to be just like him, and he doesn't want you to be just like him. He doesn't want you to have those blessings, have that insight. Go ahead and eat. That's Eve's temptation. It's about you and what's good for you. You've got to do what's good for you, Eve. And Martha the same way, in the kitchen. It's all about her responsibilities, what she's doing in that story, as you recall. And now with the older brother, it's basically what I've done, what I've accomplished. The way I've slaved away. It's about hope in the stuff here and now. It's about the kingdom without the king. And it leads to isolation. Whereas with the prodigal, we see someone who understands the value of we. And it's not just we in terms of y'all and me. It's we in terms of us and God. It's the body of Christ. It's about hope in the cross now and in the crown later. We bear a cross in this life to a banquet later. It's about the king and his kingdom. We're in his kingdom, not just the stuff. And that is the kind of intimacy that characterizes the kind of relationship that motivates people to not only receive grace, but to give grace to others. Charles Spurgeon put it this way, "Holiness is not the way to Christ. Christ is the way to holiness. Better still, Christ is our holiness." Okay, 10 signs of a religious spirit. Keeping score for credit or demerit. A sense of spiritual entitlement. Uneasy with grace given to other sinners. Rules and justice orient your life. Superficial standards that I can manage. A segregated spirit, called a class system. There are spiritual people and there are not. There are holy people and there are not. There are people who are faithful and there are not. There are carnal Christians and there are holy Christians. And usually we place ourselves in, on good days, in the upper category. Welcoming failure of others outside. Somehow we just feel better when we see someone who we regarded basically as in story one, falling through story two to the bottom. It just makes us feel a whole lot better. Because we just really feel uncomfortable with all those people in story one who are spiritual and have had, you know, all these blessings and we haven't had them. We wonder, is something wrong with us? But, oh, it feels so good when they're brought down to our level. When that happens, you probably have a religious spirit. Tendency to judge others by our strengths. And when we judge others, almost always that's the way it's done. Struggling with shame when we fail, and stingy with grace when others fail. Well, what can we do about this? A couple suggestions. Evaluate the company you keep. Religious people like religious people. Know yourself, accept yourself, forget about yourself, and give yourself. I'm going to wear this one out. I know you've heard that 60, 70 times. Prepare yourself. You're going to hear that a lot more. It is basically a theme I don't want us to forget. Following Christ starts with knowing yourself, getting it about yourself, and accepting the grace of God and yourself in that grace, and then just forgetting about yourself, and then showing up for your part in the play. Commit yourself to be a Beatitude disciple. By that I mean, look at the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5 and recognize that when Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount, when he basically raised the bar back to where it should have been, he was doing that for the purpose of bringing us to the place where we would become Beatitude Christians, hungering and thirsting for righteousness, being poor in spirit. And take the Scripture seriously, noting especially Jesus' relationships and the attention he gives to humility, brokenness, and to God's sensitivity to those like the prodigal son, like Mary, and like others. Okay, we have some minutes we can talk. By the way, next week we're going to look at another of Jesus' stories, which examines this whole matter of justice and empathy. This story ends with the question of God being unjust. We're going to pick up that theme next time. Yes.
This being Father's Day, I'm struck by how many of us, in raising our kids, is a sequence of reward and punishment and keeping score. On candy given or present
right.
given. So we need a theology on how parents can raise their kids.
Be careful here. The question is, what does this tell us about child rearing? It tells us a lot, but it doesn't tell us basically to be permissive. The law was given for a purpose. The law was given basically to show us where we fall short. And very frankly, when you raise kids, you don't want to raise them to become cats. You want them to be dumb dogs, to use the analogy. You want them to basically understand that they are not entitled to everything just because they're on the planet. That basically they have a nature that is going to be difficult for them. If you want your children to get it, they're going to have to see the dark side of their own soul. And if you keep rescuing from them from that by just being gracious at the outset, they may never see that. Now, I'm not saying be cruel to your kids, not at all. I'm saying, as a parent, our role should be helping our children find the light of who they are, but not stop there, but who God is as well. The bad news is we are needy. The good news is God is gracious. And we need to see both of those things. I think as parents, the way in which we do that is by basically having rules, the same way that God has rules that show us our heart and our neediness. I know you weren't suggesting that.
I was just thinking, you know, that my daughter homeschools our kids, and you know, when school's in, you know, the line is drawn.
Yeah, right.
And but then my son-in-law, you know, last week took my oldest grandchild out for a dad and daughter night. You know, that's great.
Yeah.
You
know? Yes. Well, I think children need to see, from dads especially, they need to see tenderness and grace. They need to see mercy, especially when they reveal their heart, when they become vulnerable. I'm very conscious of this with the great privilege we have of having our grandchildren close by. The other day, little Sasha came in after a play date with her friends, and all of her friends had the same doll. I can't remember the name of it, but it's a hot doll right now. All the little girls have it. But she didn't have one. She was the only girl who didn't have one, and she was crying. I said, "What's wrong, Sasha?" I couldn't understand her. So I said, "Sasha, come here." And so I sat on my lap. I said, "Did you have a good time at the party?" And she said, "No, they all had such and such doll, and I didn't have one." But I said, "Well, you've got Pinky, your little elephant." I said, "Well, but they all had stuffed animals too, you know." I said, "Sasha, I understand. That's okay. I'm sorry." I mean, she, at that point, what she needs is not someone to say, "Come on, Sasha, grow up."
"I'll buy you one."
"I'll buy yeah. Or I'll buy you one," right. I think what she needs to hear is that when she feels left out, I feel left out with her. I can affirm her feeling of being left out. That sense of mercy, not judging, not saying, "Well, why didn't you get one? You know, or why don't you have one?" And kind of thing. As parents, I think if we're wise, we should be full of mercy and grace, but know when and how to use that, how to show tenderness as opposed to withhold it.
And like the parable, we need to allow our children to make their own mistakes.
That's right.
And
that's
the father
right.
Let the prodigal son go.
And knowing,
had to learn.
Knowing when to let them go and when not to is a tough call.
Yes, that's critical.
That's critical, because you can let them go in ways that are really destructive, but if you hold on to them, that can be destructive too. So there's a lot to be learned from the parable in that respect. But I think that the whole point of mercy, I've talked to parents, fathers who have never forgiven their children for things they've done. That they, fathers, if they only knew how devastating that was to a child's heart to never feel the acceptance of their father. Mm-hmm. And I know as a grandfather, one of the great gifts I can give to my kids and to my grandkids is to let them know I really delight in them and I'm pleased with them, in spite of the fact that they don't do everything the way I would. Matter of fact, thank God they don't. But that's the role of a father. It's to, in the story, it's the father's role is to basically be the prodigal with respect to the lavishness of his grace.
And as grandparents, we need to allow our children to make their own mistakes raising their kids.
Right.
We can't tell them how to do it.
Right.
They won't let us.
Yes, Joe.
Jim, I think at least I can sort of identify with the prodigal, and I can identify with the older brother. And I kind of come up with a question about, is the purpose of this parable to cause us to aspire to be like the Father, or to recognize we can never be like the Father?
No, I think it's the question is, in this story, we can identify with all of them to a certain extent. What should we aspire to? And I think what you're saying, what you're asking is, should we aspire to be like the Father? Of course. We should aspire to be gracious, to see others the way he does. But we're not going to do that perfectly. We're going to have enough of the sons in us that we're not going to be perfectly like the Father. But we should have a lot of the Father's instincts in us. When we see the Father's behavior here, we just say, I'm familiar with that. I know what that feels like. I know what he felt. I felt that. And I've acted that way. We should hopefully have those parts of our story.
Well, I wonder if it isn't to sort of break us and humble us to, you know, the grace of God that we can never, you know, come close to. So we can kind of see it, we can understand it, but it will always be different than what we are capable of ever being. You know, we
won't be perfect, of course. But I think the next parable is going to deal with basically forgiveness and graciousness in terms of how do you get there and what's involved with that. It's a story of a master and a slave, both who were owed a great deal, and what we can learn from both. Yes?
There's one thought that maybe shines through this particular parable that just came to me. It's a very simple principle that's being expressed in the words, mercy triumphs over judgment.
Yeah.
And that is where all of us fit in and have to find our place. Yeah.
Mercy triumphs over judgment. That's a theme in Jesus' teaching. Okay.